This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Then this evening, part of the reason for the very harsh way in which the Ribbono Shel Olam judges tzaddikim. There are many cases in the Gemara, in the Chumash itself, in the Torah itself. We have many cases of what would appear to be unreasonably harsh reactions on the part of the Ribbono Shel Olam to what would appear to be relatively minor actions of various tzaddikim. In the Gemara there are also many, many, many cases. What comes to mind, for example, is the terrible punishment that the daughter of Rabbi Chanina ben Tradion suffered. In the way the Mesillas Yeshurim explains the Gemara, how she used to walk with tremendous, she used to be a very tzniyustik person, the way she walked, the way she dressed. And when she heard herself being praised by people about how beautifully she walks and what a beautiful woman she was, she used to be careful to be even more tzniyustik. And because of that, she suffered some terrible things, says the Gemara. And Mrs. Shorim says it's because she improved her tzniyus to satisfy public demand, rather than because of an internal thing. So what? But the fact is, she was even more tzniyus than she was before, she was even more modest than she was before, so it was to satisfy public demand. So what? Why did she have to suffer so terribly for that? There's a case that the Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, I think it was going by the way, and he saw this girl who was terribly poor and stopped. Morin Kesubis stopped. She stopped to ask him for some tzedakah, and he says to her, "Who are you? What family are you from?" And she says, "I'm from the family of Nachman ben Gurion." And he says, "You're from the family. Your father's Nachman ben Gurion, but he's a multimillionaire. Why are you collecting money? What's happened?" And she says, "No longer. He's not a multimillionaire any longer." And he says, "Why? What happened? What happened to his fortune?" And she says, "He didn't give enough tzedakah. If a person has money and they want to preserve their money, they should give tzedakah, because that cost is an insurance against future loss. So it's one of the best investments to make," she says. And he didn't give enough. And the Gemara asks, "But Nachman ben Gurion, what do you mean he didn't give tzedakah? He's given as one of the examples of the most outstanding balei tzedakah. He used to give fortunes to tzedakah. And he used to give it in a very fine way. He used to walk, and the aniyim, the poor people, used to lay out sacks and things in front of him, and he used to walk, and they used to pick up the money behind him, so that he wouldn't see who got the money. He wouldn't see. He just used to drop it on the floor, and they used to come and pick it up, so he would never see who was getting it. They would never felt that he saw who was getting it." And he's always brought as an example of a big baal tzedakah. And the Gemara answers, "But he did it lichvei datsma. He did it for self-aggrandizement." And Reb Chaim Shmulevitz used to ask, and he used to bring Gemaras, the Moran Tainis and others, that say quite clearly that it was accepted by the Ribbono Shel Olam, never mind by Nachman ben Gurion himself, that he claimed and he said, "All this that I've done, don't think I've done for myself. I've done it all for you, Ribbono Shel Olam." And the Ribbono Shel Olam seems to accept that. So what can it be? It can only be that there was some tiny, minute, subconscious pleasure he got out of giving the tzedakah. That's all it could be. His conscious effort was clearly l'shem shemayim. His conscious effort was clearly not l'chved atzma. And as a result of that, he loses all his fortune. He did give tzedakah enough to make us lose heart totally. Not even Ben Gurion loses his fortune because that's not called giving tzedakah. If that's not called giving tzedakah, what is anything that we do called? What chance have we got? One reads some of these chazal, one reads some of these Gemaras and Maimre Chazal, and one feels almost disheartened to the point, if that's the way the Ribbono Shel Olam punishes people for such minute things, what chance have we got? And yes, we know that that's how he deals with great people, with Gedolim. He doesn't deal with us that way. But then we almost feel as though, who wants to aspire to be a great person if that's the way you're going to be judged? Who needs it? But we'll understand a little more of that. At the same time, we'll understand the day-to-day equivalent. And that is the kind of question that we pose. I suppose we could pose it now in what's going on in America. We see how presidents of the United States are treated. They are treated worse than we treat our street cleaners. Yes, they're given lots of covers, and they drive around in fancy cars, and people salute them, and yes sir, no sir. But look how they're treated in the press, look how they're treated by the public, look what disgrace they're put to constantly. You don't have to look to America, you can look to England. And see what delight the press takes in destroying its leadership. What delight, and if they can reduce them to tears, then that's the absolute best. So they treat their leadership worse than we would treat servants. Not worse than we do, or worse than we would treat servants. Even in this country, in the height of the apartheid years, they treat their kings and queens and presidents worse than we would. Nobody would have treated their servants with such delight at seeing them suffer. Trying to make them suffer as much as you can. Torture them as much as you can. That's how they treat them. What makes a millionaire like Ross Perot? He's got a nice business going, he's got a nice family, he's living a nice quiet life. What makes a... Where does he get the mishugas from to be a president? What's he wanted for? What on earth does he want it for? And in fact, they were just saying in America until recently that anybody who's talented and sane wouldn't take the job, not for anything in the world. So you land up with mishugoyim, with people who've got nothing better to do. That's how the system is designed. It's not the kind of job that is attractive to anybody. Yet you see that it is attractive to people. And you wonder, one wonders why. What is it? To do it for the money, there's no money in it. To do it for the covered, there's no covered in it. What does he want it for? What's he going to get out of it? The British kings and queens, it's a little bit more difficult to answer the question because they didn't stand for election. They didn't go for the job, but they could step down. They could abdicate. They could say, leave us alone. Let's live our private lives. Forget it. You don't want a king and queen. We're wealthy enough as it is. We don't need the income. Leave us alone. Leave us with one of our little estates. Take all your palaces and castles, and we'll live very nicely on our own. We really don't need this. What do they need it for? Why don't they say that? Isn't that the obvious thing to do? Why does a person who has made a lot of money continue to struggle and to work, to build and to conquer still more? What is it that drives people to that? It's only one aspect of all this that we'll try and understand a little bit more clearly tonight, based on the Medrash Tanchuma that we discussed last night. And I mentioned to you last night that there are two parts to the Medrash, and this evening we'll learn both parts. Let's start off, as we did last night, with the second part of the Medrash, which is based on the Pasuk that says, Vayehi b'yom chalos kalos Moshe. And it was on the day that Moshe completed the Mishkan. And Rashi brings the Medrash and asks, it wasn't Moshe who built the Mishkan? The Mishkan was built by the entire nation. Everybody had a part in it. They all worked very hard. They all donated money, they all invested in it, and they all donated labor. They all actually worked. The men, the women, everybody. The women sewed and weaved, and the men built and constructed. The whole nation was involved in the building of the Mishkan. Moshe just came in the very end. He put it together. And in fact, and he put it together by a miracle. He tried to do it himself, he couldn't. It was too heavy, it was too difficult. So the Ben Shem did it for him. It looked as if he was doing it. So in fact, Moshe probably worked least for the whole Mishkan. Why does it say on the day that Moshe finished putting up the Mishkan? It wasn't Moshe, it was the whole of Yisrael. Why doesn't everybody get credit? So the Medrash Tanchuma brings the Pasuk from Mishlei, Notzer Te'eino Yoichal Pirya. It's the one who guards, who looks after, who nurtures the fig tree that eats from its fruit. And the Medrash says that the Ribbono Shel Olam doesn't withhold recognition from anybody. V'chein ata mritzei b'mishka she'akol nosnu es nafshom v'osu es ha-mishka. All of Klal Yisrael dedicated themselves and gave to the Mishkan. Kol Yisrael nisnagvu, all of Yisrael volunteered and donated. Hanoshim tovu esayizim, the women weaved. Mechin v'yasu kol chachmei lechol chacham lev, all the wise people participated. Mechin also betzalel and oholiyov all participated. They all designed and made the Mishkan. Why does Moshe get the credit? Bishvil shenosam Moshe napshu olov shiyase k'shem shehero lo yakadosh baruch hu b'har. Answers the Medrash, because Moshe dedicated himself. He was Moshe nefesh to make sure that the Mishkan would be finished in accordance with the details that were given to him on the Har Sinai. V'holach Moshe v'nosa nafshe shelo yitu, and Moshe went with mesirus nefesh that they shouldn't make any mistakes. Kaksi v'kol dova v'dova. That's why it says about each thing that they made, Kashe tzivu Hashem es Moshe. Each thing was done as Hashem instructed Moshe. And that's all very nice. Moshe went around and made sure that the Mishkan was made in accordance with Hashem's will. That's all very good, but it doesn't really answer the question. The question is, everybody participated. Good, so we've been told what Moshe's job was. Everybody had a job. And Moshe's job was to check that the final product conformed to the specifications given on HaSinai. He was quality control. Good, so we know what Moshe did. But that doesn't mean that what he did was more valuable or more important than what everybody else did. And the Medrash itself says, in fact, they all were Moshe Nefesh. It's not just that they all did something. They all did it with Mesiris Nefesh. Moshe wasn't the only one who did it with Mesiris Nefesh. He wasn't the only one who really gave of his life for it, who gave it with self-sacrifice. They all gave self-sacrifice to the construction of the Mishkan, not only Moshe. So it doesn't really help us. All the Midrash has told us is what part Moshe played, that it wasn't just that he put it together. He did more than that. The whole quality control of each section of the Mishkan was under Moshe's control. But still, that doesn't mean that it should say that when Moshe finished building the Mishkan, it wasn't just Moshe. Why is what Moshe did called Mesiris Nefesh? And why does it justify having the whole Mishkan called on his name? There is an aspect of quality control that applies in every situation. And we need to understand the importance of it and the frustrations of it. Imagine for example that a hostess is going to have a large dinner party, and she's a wealthy person, so she's got many servants. She doesn't have to do it all herself, and she arranges on a particular evening she's going to hold the dinner party, and she starts planning well before then exactly what she's going to make and how it's going to be prepared. And a few days before that she starts getting all the ingredients together, and she organizes the chefs and the cooks and the maids, and everything's done, and the food is cooked and the tables are laid and so on. Flowers are ordered, things are put out, furniture is laid out in accordance with the plans. Everything's done. What does she do? Well, she doesn't do an awful lot. And what happens at the end of the suda? Everybody comes, 50 people come, they have a wonderful dinner party. And what do they do at the end of it? They all thank her for a wonderful dinner party and how beautiful it was and how tasty the food was. Really fantastic. And the cook's sitting in the kitchen and he hears this, he doesn't get thanked. And the maids are sitting in the kitchen and they don't get thanked. And they think to themselves, is this really fair? Look what we did. We worked for days for this. What did she do? What did the madam do? Absolutely nothing. And they all say thank you to her, and she still accepts the thanks. She doesn't say it wasn't me, it was the maids, it was the chef. She says, it's a pleasure, come again, please, you enjoyed it, as if it was all her. And out they go. Who's right? Is the madam right or are the cooks right? So let's see if it's really true that the madam did nothing. What did she do? Well, one of the things she did is after the table was laid, just before the guests came in, or a few hours before the guests came in, she came on an inspection, no doubt. And she did little things. She fitzfutzed with the flowers, and she changed one flower here and one flower there, and she moved the bowl, and she put this one here, and she put that one there. And she walked around, and she polished a little smudge on one of the knives, and she put a glass in the correct position, and she noticed a tiny chip on one of the glasses, and she took it into the kitchen, and she brought out another one to replace it. And she walked around, and she called one of the servants, because one of the windows was smudged, one of the children had made a smudge on it, and she calls one of the servants to clean the window. And the servant says, but the curtains will be closed, you won't even see the window. She says, doesn't matter, you clean the window too. And the servant cleans it and she closes. And so she goes around. And she did the same in the kitchen. While the food was being cooked with all her servants and her chefs and her bakers and her cooks doing all the work in the kitchen, she was going around and she was noticing that something needed a little bit more salt and something needed a little bit more of a spice and something wasn't cooking at quite the right temperature. And she adjusts the oven and she walks around and keeps her finger involved in everything just to see that everything's just right. What we're looking at here is in the manufacturing process. We're looking at two parts of the process, and we're going to look at a third. The first part is the bulk of the process, the mass. Getting the material ready, producing the material, that's 99% of the volume of the effort. And then we're looking at one little touch, which is that finishing touch, that quality control. That end little thing, putting that extra spice in, turning up the temperature, stirring up the pot, polishing the smudge off the knife, changing the glass around, those little things. Is there any way that anybody could notice those little things? No. You're not going to know that there was a chipped glass and the hostess took the trouble to change it. You're not going to know that there was a smudged knife and that the hostess took the trouble to polish the smudge. You're not going to know that behind the curtains there was a smudge on the window and the hostess called the girl in to polish off the smudge and to clean the window. You're not going to know that. So all the things she did, you're not going to know about. So in a sense, her job is much more frustrating than anybody else's job. That final quality control, those tiny little touches, when you look at each thing on its own, each thing is meaningless. And if you did challenge her after, and you said, you know, if you were standing there waiting to be the last guest out, and you said, you know, my dear friend, it isn't fair what you do standing here taking all the praise. What did you really do? Tell us the truth. How much of this did you really do? How many man hours went into the preparation of this dinner party? And she says, goodness, how many man hours? Probably 100, 200 man hours went into it. And how many of those man hours were yours? About 2-3 hours. And then the person says, is that really fair that out of 3% of the work is yours and you're getting all the praise? And what did you do? Tell us what you did. And she says, well, come, I'll show you. You see that carnation in that vase? I changed it. It was first in that vase. I put it there. So you should care. Very nice. What else did you do? She says, well, behind the curtains there was a smudge on the window. I had it cleaned. Care. Very nice. Very good. And that soup that you had, I put a bit more salt in it. Very nice. Each thing she does is meaningless. When you look at each, when you break her work down into its different components, each thing is trivial. Absolutely trivial. And if she allows herself to look at her work in its broken components, she begins to feel the triviality of what she's doing. It is trivial. And yet, when those guests went away and said, this was an unbelievable experience, what did they mean? What was different to the supper they could have had at home? What was different to the dinner they would have had if they'd been invited to somebody else's? What was specific about that particular dinner party? It was those little touches, although they don't know it. Because the sum total of the effect of those little touches is a picture of perfection. And when they're really saying thank you to her, that was magnificent. That's what they mean. That was magnificent. And so it is in every area. If you analyze what it is that made the experience, instead of being ordinary, to be one that is magnificent, you'll find it's very little. It's very small things that do it. You can listen to Beethoven's violin concerto being played by one violinist, and you can listen to it being played by another violinist, and people will come out of the first concert and they're in the foyer and they're already talking about where should we go for coffee. And out of the second concert, people are in the foyer and there's the stunned silence. Nobody's talking at all. And when they start talking, it's with a sense of, oh, wasn't that magnificent? And you say, now what was the difference? The music was the same. Every note that Beethoven wrote, both concerts were played. No one left out a note. They were both good orchestras, both had the same number of instruments, both had a soloist who practiced many hours to perform. What was the difference? If you'll allow yourself to analyze and to break down the components of the differences, they're trivial. It was the way, did you notice the sixth note in the 24th bar of the second movement, that pause before that he made? Did you notice that? How perfect it was. Good. Okay, so it was a microsecond longer or shorter than the other fellows. That's all. But those are the things that make the difference. That's what makes that incredible. That's what makes that uplifting. That's what makes that dramatic. That's what makes it perfect. Whereas the other one's ordinary. So 99% of the effort is exactly the same. 99% of the product is indistinguishable. It's in tiny, minute little details. If you analyze, most people don't analyze. They just know for whatever reason. The one was exceptional and the other was ordinary. And most people aren't able to tell you unless they're experts in the field. Unless they've done it themselves. If you're a violinist, you'll have noticed the difference. If you've played in an orchestra, you will have noticed the difference. If you've held a dinner party, you will have noticed the little things. But if you're a man who's never held a dinner party, it's always your wife who does that, or you've never played the violin, you won't notice it. You won't know what into it. You went into it. You don't know how it could have been. You don't know why it was like that. All you know is that the general effect was one of incredible beauty, of incredible perfection, of upliftment, of something very, very special. but you won't be able to necessarily put your finger on it. But if you do put your finger on the detailed components of the difference between that which is ordinary and that which is exceptional, you'll find that very trivial things that all add up to make a difference which is not trivial at all. And you'll find that 99% of it is the same in the ordinary one as it is in the different one. So as we said last night, it's that extra mile that makes the difference. It's the end, it's that finishing touch that makes the difference. And so it is, I told you last night about the question that Mr. Hugh Reichlin asked me as to why it is that the Ribbono Shel created such enormous beauty as the marine life in tropical and in regular seas, which nobody really gets to see. And only somebody who's been skin diving can see on coral reefs. Will know what a breathtaking, literally breathtaking, you actually lose your breath when you see it the first time, because no matter what you're expecting, it's just something far more beautiful than anything you can possibly expect. The colour, there isn't colour on land as there is under the sea. There isn't that variety of colour, there isn't that richness of colour anywhere in nature. Why does the Ribbono Shel Olam make the most colourful part of the Bria deep in the sea, where you have to be a bit of a meshugana to go and have a look at it? It's not a normal thing to go diving into the sea to have a look at that. That's not what one sees in the normal passage of life. You've got to deviate from life in order to see it. Why does he do that? And as we said last night, the Ribbono Shel Olam makes a planet Earth, and he makes hundreds of other planets and stars, thousands, millions, and they all have a certain beauty to them. But when you look at the pictures of Earth as seen from the moon, you realize that the most beautiful planet of all is Earth. Why does the Ribbono Shel Olam make the planet that is most beautiful to look at the one planet that we can't see because we're on it? What's the point of that beauty? And so if we think that beauty is just for the beholder, you see that isn't so. That the Ribbono Shel Olam went out of his way to bring about aesthetic perfection even in areas where there's no chance of any human being seeing it. Well, if there is, it's the odd human being who will. An astronaut goes out there and he sees what the world looks like from there, or the odd skin diver, or the Himalaya mountains. Imagine what it must be to look down from the top, from the peaks of the Himalayas, to look over that expanse of mountains. Just imagine what a sight that must be. What percentage of humanity have seen that? What percentage of humanity have seen any of the wonders of the Boreh? And if you go from the wonderfully large and magnificent down to the microcosmic, and you go to the microscopic areas of beauty, some of the molecular structures that there are, the beauty, the synthesis, the harmony in molecular structure which we've only become aware of recently. And again, how few people are really aware of it. How much you need to study in order to be able to appreciate it. And how many areas there are of the Ribbono Shel Olam's wisdom in the world that you have to study for years and years and years before you can begin to appreciate how brilliant it is. And what percentage of the population develops an appreciation of that brilliance in any specific field, whether it's in mathematics or it's in medicine, and in what part of medicine, in what branch of medicine, or in computers and electronics, or in whatever area. Such wonders of the Bria, but look what a mumche you've got to be, look what enormous effort you've got to go to before you can even see how wonderful the Ribbono Shel Olam is. So he clearly didn't do it in order for us to see. He didn't expect that, that's not what he wants. It's true, we've developed sophistication, but we didn't do it in order to discover the greatness of Hashem. And the fact is, it doesn't bring us to that. People aren't more religious today than they used to be because we know all these things. It hasn't had that effect. So clearly Hashem's intention was not to create all this wonder in order to make us more religious. So what was his intention? Why is there all this wonder? Why is there all this perfection? Why is there all this beauty in areas where there's nobody to see it even? But that's like the smudge on the window behind the curtains. It shouldn't be there, that smudge on the window. It has no place being there. And it bothers the hostess and she has it cleaned. Why? Not because anybody will notice. Not because anybody will see the difference, but because it disturbs the sense of aesthetic perfection. It just shouldn't be there. And if in the course of Beethoven's violin concerto, the violinist thinks to himself, you know, as he's practicing and he's trying to perfect a particular phrase, and eventually it's not coming right, and eventually he says to himself, so what's the terrible thing? It's time to go to bed now already. Concert's tomorrow. What will happen? I'll play it the other way. I'll play it the way that I'm not all that happy with. Who in the audience will notice? The answer is nobody in the audience will notice. But he'll notice. And that's why he carries on and on and on perfecting it. If he's going to be the second violinist and not the first violinist will go to bed. And the second violinist will carry on and on and on until he's perfected it. And he's right and he's wrong. He's right that nobody will notice it. But there will be the noticing of the sum total of the effect of artistic perfection, of artistic greatness, that there will be. And so we're not aware there are so many apparently trivial details in the Bria, tiny little things that Hashem created that we don't even understand why and what their place is. Beauty that Hashem created which really wouldn't make much difference to the world if it wasn't there, or so we think. It doesn't matter. It's there not just for us to see. It's there because that's the way of the Ribbono Shel Olam. The Ribbono Shel Olam demands a certain perfection of himself and of us. And perhaps the word perfection is a little bit too demanding in the sense, perhaps the word we used last night is more apt, a certain completeness. A thing needs to be completed. And completed means down to the last detail. If it's incomplete, it's not satisfactory. And we do understand that. We understand that we have that within ourselves. We see the Ribbono Shel Olam implanted that demand within ourselves. We don't demand it of ourselves very easily. We sometimes are quite satisfied when we're the suppliers. We don't mind if we don't finish our jobs down to the last detail. But we do mind when somebody else who's supplying goods or services to us doesn't finish the job down to the last detail. If we're writing a letter and there's one spelling mistake in it, so we scratch it out, we fix it. If we write a letter and there's a grammatical phrase which isn't quite correct, so we either correct it or we leave it, it's not the end of the world and we let it go. But if our secretaries give us a letter typed out and there's a spelling mistake and she scratched it out with a pen and wrote it in, we get very upset. And she says, but what is the difference? The person will read it, will he be able to understand the letter? Yes, he will understand. Will there be any misunderstanding? No. Is he going to hate you because I crisscrossed out the letter? Is he going to refuse to read it? What difference does it make? The answer is, that's not how you send out the letter. That's all. Why not? Because that's not a complete. It's lacking completion. We don't do that kind of thing. Those are standards we do set for others, or perhaps standards we used to set for others. Now we're becoming lax even in the extent to which we set those standards for others. And the examples I gave last night, where we pay a lot of money, we certainly expect those standards. When you buy an article, you go and you buy a shirt in the shop and you spend a fair amount of money, or a blouse or whatever, and you come to, they give you the blouse or the shirt, and you see it's not the right size, not the size. Oh, no problem, she says, what size? She goes back, brings the right size. And he said, but look, it's dirty here, and it's a second hand. She says, no, it's not second hand, but you know, it's been in the shop a while, people have tried it on, and so you say, no, thank you. Have you got a new one? She says, it isn't you. She says, no, I mean, without spots all over it. She says, but don't you launder it in any case before you wear it? You launder it. So put it through the washing machine once, it will come out fine. You won't tell the difference. What do you say? Oh, yes, you're right. Good idea. Fine. After you don't. You demand perfection. It doesn't make a difference. The truth is, it doesn't make a difference. You will put it through a laundry, and it will be just as clean. Or the example of the motor car that I gave last night. You spend a lot of money on a motor car, and when it's delivered to you, you take delivery. There are finger marks on it. There are little specks all over it. You say, one second, is this a new car? Yeah, this is a new car, but there were kids here this afternoon playing around. They got their hands all over it. Please clean it, you say. I say, one second, where are you driving to from here? They say, I'm going home. They say, you got little kids? Yes. And when you get home, are your little kids going to come looking at the car? Yes, they're going to come looking at the car. How long do you think it will take before their finger marks all over it again? So what does it bother you that their finger marks now? You don't accept that. You say, you take those finger marks off, and I'll drive it out here without any finger marks on. My children will put finger marks on, that's my business. Why are we in the sugar? What difference does it make if the finger marks are now, they'll be on in 5 minutes' time? What difference does it make? But we are meshuggah about that. Why are we meshuggah about that? Because we're made by the Ribbono Shel Olam. We have something godly in us. And we like completeness. Even though that completeness won't last, even though we're talking about things which might deteriorate and that completeness might go, it doesn't matter. That's why people are prepared to pay more for new items than for second-hand items. Does it make any commercial sense to buy things new? Clothes, motor cars, houses? Does it make any commercial sense to buy them new when you can get the same item cheaper without any problems? Take a motor car that's been driven for 2 kilometers, 10 kilometers, and it's brand new, you have it tested, there's nothing wrong with it. It still doesn't have the same value or the same price as a motor car that hasn't been driven at all. Why? Because we like completeness, and we're willing to pay for that completeness. It means something to us. And so it should. Whether we want to or we don't want to, whether we want to compromise and take something cheaper that is secondhand, that's our own commercial decisions. But there is a value that society attaches to something complete, to something brand new and untouched. And when we invest in something brand new and untouched, we expect it to be delivered in a condition of being brand new and untouched and perfect. And that's why all these manufacturers now offer guarantees. Now, what is the guarantee saying? The guarantee isn't saying we're expecting it to break down and we'll fix it if it does. What the guarantee is really saying is that we're so sure that it won't break down that if you have a problem, we'll do it for nothing. And people like that. That means it's quality. They're buying something good. And people are willing to pay a little bit more for something that is complete. There is such a value. We do understand it in the service we demand from others. So why shouldn't we demand it in the service we demand from ourselves? Whether we're giving that service to others, or we're giving that service to ourselves, or we're giving that service to the Ribbono Shel Olam. What does the Ribbono Shel Olam do with a korban, with a sacrifice that is nearly perfect? Animal is brought, it's almost okay, it has a slight limp, it's got a fracture in one of its bones, but it will be okay, it will get right again. What does the Ribbono Shel Olam do with that? It's unacceptable. It's not acceptable, just the same as Lahavdil, the car with the marks on it can't be driven out of the showroom. It's just not acceptable, not good enough. And what does the Novi say? Why isn't it good enough? Hashem says, would you bring such an animal to your princes if you were giving it as a gift? Do you give a second-hand item as a gift to somebody? When you're going to give it, look how it is, how important these things are to us. If it really makes commercial sense to buy second-hand, what do we do when we're giving a gift to somebody? You want to give somebody a vase for their flowers, you want to give them a nice silver tray, whatever it is, do you go to the second-hand shop and buy one there and give it? I'm not talking about antiques, just ordinary second-hand. Surely that makes more sense. And then you say to the person, you know, I had a certain amount to spend on you, and I'm sure you'll understand, I went to a second-hand shop because for the same amount of money that I was going to spend on this gift, I could get much more value. I could give you something much better. That's why I went to the second-hand shop. Doesn't that make a lot of sense? It makes perfect business sense. But we don't do it because we're not businessmen. We're creations of the Ribbono Shel Olam. And in giving a gift, there's a feeling of completion. We like to give something that's brand new, that's spick and span, and that's complete, and that hasn't been touched by anybody else. We like that. There's an aspect, there's an element of that completeness which is important to us. And so it is with a sacrifice too. And if there's something in the thought process which is not accurate when we bring a korban, the korban is rejected. And if there's something in the performance of any of the avodas which is not perfect, the korban is rejected. The Ribbono Shel Olam doesn't say, I'll take it at a discount. He says, I won't take it at all. It has no more value to me. This is not a gift. This is not a sacrifice. This lacks perfection. And there are certain things in life that need perfection. There are certain things in life that need completion. And the person in the manufacturing process who is responsible for that completeness, what part of it is he really responsible for? If we go back to our hostess and she moved the carnation from the one vase into the other and she rubbed the smudge off the knife and she changed the chipped glass for a proper glass and she cleaned the smudge off the window, what did she do? What part of the dinner was she responsible for? The answer is for everything. All those things were just parts of a complete whole which she presented to her guests. And the way that presentation appeared in its entirety and its integrity was a product of that woman, of that hostess. True, the chef did the cooking and the baker did the baking and the maids did the laying of the table and they were doing the washing up. Each one had their parts to play. But the person who tied it all together in something perfect and elevating was the hostess. And therefore it's proper that she gets the credit for it. What happens in the reverse situation? If people come to the dinner party and the food's virtually the same, it's not less nutritious and it's not less filling. Everybody's going away feeling just as satisfied. Same kind of dinner. Just in the soup there wasn't quite the right kind of spicing and one or two of the knives were smudged and there was a chipped glass on the table. Little things, nothing, each thing on its own, trivial, doesn't make all that difference. But people didn't go away with that same feeling of, oof, this was an experience. Who's responsible for that? Can she say, oh, it's my cook? You know, it's the maid should have checked the glasses. She didn't. These maids, you can't rely on them today. You know, they're not like they used to be. And look how they clean the cutlery. The cutlery is not in the old days. Do you remember how the maids used to clean the cutlery? In the old days, the maids used to clean the cutlery like that because the madams used to stand behind them watching them cleaning the cutlery. That's why they did it. That's the only difference. The difference is not in the maids. The difference is in the madams. She can't blame it on anybody else. Quality control is the manager's job. The manager gets the credit, and the manager must be big enough to take the complaints when they come. It's not anybody else's fault. It's his fault. The way he's managed the people. That's all it is. And so what did Moshe Rabbeinu do with the Mishkan? Quality control. He went around as each component was being made to make sure that they don't make mistakes. That's incredible. The person whose job it is to see that people don't make mistakes, that's the most thankless of all jobs. Because nobody will know that he was doing anything. If a person goes and does something and says, look, that's the wall I built. That's the carpet I wove. That's the piece of metal that I designed. Each person can look at something in the Mishkan and say, that's what I did. Moshe comes into the Mishkan, looks around, there's nothing he did. It was all done by others. All he did was make sure that everything should be right, that nobody should make any mistakes. That's the most valuable thing of all. That's again, back to the case of the hostess. She's going around in the kitchen and she's watching, even if she doesn't have to add any salt to it, even if her chef is a cordon bleu and the maids have been trained properly and there's nothing to do and there's no smudging on the cutlery and the chipped glass hasn't been put on the table, even if everything has been done perfectly without her, she was there watching, making sure that it was going to be that way. And she knows very well that if she holds 3 or 4 dinner parties without being there during the preparation time, it won't take very long before standards start to drop. It won't take very long before the food doesn't taste quite the same, and before there are smudges on the cutlery and there are chips on the glasses. It won't take very long. The maintenance of standards, at least, is the manager's job. And that's thankless because you don't see anything for it. And the better your staff is, the less you see of it. Except if you understand, you know, that the functioning of the whole thing is yours. You've put the whole thing together. And that if you wouldn't be there, then you would notice. That's one of the sad parts of lots of things in human life. We only notice them when they're not there. Take the hostess away and see what kind of dinner party they would have been able to put together without her. Then we understand what she does. Take Moshe Rabbeinu out of the picture of the Mishkan and see what a mess there might have been. Little things, trivial things, but it wouldn't have been exactly as the Ribbono Shel Olam specified. And if it wouldn't have been exactly as the Ribbono Shel Olam specified, it wouldn't have held together. That's the role of the manager. And it's true that he has to take the complaints. If things haven't gone right, he's got to be able to accept that the buck stops with him. But on the other hand, he gets the credit when things do go right. And that's how it is, how the Ribbono Shel Olam is with the tzaddikim. They are the ones who put the finishing touches onto their actions and onto the actions of the Olam. Little small things, whether it's the daughter of Rabbi Hanina ben Tradje, or it was the case of Nachman ben Gurion, all the other hundreds of cases in the Gemara and in the Chumash and in the Tanakh, all these cases of what appear to us to be small things, and the Ribbono Shel Olam comes down on them like a ton of bricks. Why? Because they're not the laborers. They are the managers. And imagine, perhaps in our case it wouldn't be the end of the world, but imagine we're talking about Buckingham Palace or the White House and there's a chipped glass on the table. That's very serious. And how much blame is attached to the maid or to the butler who put that glass on the table? A certain amount of blame. He might get scolded. But if the whole thing isn't right and there's a chipped glass and a smudged piece of cutlery and the flowers aren't right, what happens to the manager? He's in real trouble. And you say, but it's trivialities. What's wrong? What, did anybody go away hungry? Did anybody really have a bad time? What was wrong? So there was a bit of a smudge on here and there was a crack on there. What does it matter? For a manager, that matters a lot. It's just not good enough. And the manager of a motor car showroom is selling new cars and all the cars are smudged and they're all looking dirty. And the balabos comes along and he says, excuse me, why do the cars look like this? No wonder you're not selling. And he says, what's wrong with them? Anything wrong? And the manager and the owner says, look at them, they're all dirty. And he says, but then when they go out, after they bought them, in 10 minutes time it's going to be dirty. It's raining outside. Anybody who buys a car today, in 2 minutes it's going to be dirty. Why should we go cleaning the car before they're taking them outside? That manager sacked immediately. What difference does it make to the car? It makes a difference. It's the difference between doing the business properly or not doing the business properly. For a manager, that's serious. And for tzaddikim and for the great people who lead the world, small trivialities make all the difference. they're just not acceptable by the Ribbono Shel Olam. It has to be perfect. He doesn't expect perfection from us, because we're just the laborers. We're the cooks, we're the bottle washers, we're the people who do the work in the kitchen. If we slip up here or there, okay, he'll scold us, he'll tell us it's not right. But he's not going to come down with us like a ton of bricks, the way he comes down on our G'dayli Yisrael when the generation isn't right. On the other hand, we don't get all the credit either. When things are going well, they get the credit, we don't. So we have to see both sides of the coin. And that's why, says the Medrash, Moshe Rabbeinu is given the credit for the building of the Mishkan. Not that he did all the labor. Although labor, a great deal of work is involved in labor. But the final responsibility is the finishing touch, the responsibility of the attention to detail. That's the responsibility that gets the credit. And it's that area, it's the area of that attention to detail, that final quality control, where we have to place a lot of emphasis, and where a lot of the reward is given. And that's why the managers get paid more than the laborers, although the laborers maybe work harder. But at the end of the day, what's important is that attention to detail. And the people whose job it is to assure perfection of the end product, irrespective of how physically demanding that job might or might not be, they need to get paid a lot more than the people who merely manufacture the product. But there's another side to the Medrash too. The Medrash starts off with another example of the same concept, and says, Shlomo bono beis hamikdash. Who built the temple? Who built the beis hamikdash, the first beis hamikdash? Shlomo hamelech did. Shneimah vayivin Shlomo es habayis vayichalev. As it says in Malachim, that Shlomo hamelech built the beis hamikdash and he completed it. So, if we're looking at completion and quality control, that was all Shlomo HaMelech's business. Shlomo HaMelech directed the labor, and he controlled the quality. Vayichaleyu, he finished it. Uvishvil shenosan David nafsho al beis hamikdash yibone. But David was moser nefesh for that beis hamikdash. David, Shlomo's father. Shneimah, as it says in one of the Shir HaMaalos, Zechor Hashem leDavid es kol anusoy. Remember Hashem for David all of his suffering. Asher nishbo la Hashem neder la'avi Yaakov. He took an oath to Hashem, and his oath was im ovoi be'ohel beisi im ale al osi yutzui ad emtzo mokim la'Hashem. David HaMelech took an oath that he wouldn't sleep one unnecessary moment, nor would he sleep in his own bed until the Ribbono Shel Olam had a Beis HaMikdash. So there was this king in this beautiful palace that had been built, and he used to sleep on a stretcher just for a very short while. The Zohar and Vayigas says this was a neder he took that resulted in him never sleeping past midnight. That was the latest he would ever sleep. Midnight he used to get up. That was David HaMelech. And one can imagine being a king running a kingdom, he didn't manage to get to bed necessarily at 6 o'clock in the evening. So he didn't have an awful lot of sleep. And that was the neder he took. Why? Because that was me. It was me. If we're going to call that middle function labor, and we're going to call that last function management, it's the manager's job to see that the end product is just right. That first function is perhaps the most important function of all, and the one which is generally overlooked, and that's the function of leadership. And leadership and management are completely different. Leadership is the man who has the vision, or the woman who has the vision, who has the picture of the end product long before it begins. So if my say, the machshava techila, we say, the end product starts with somebody's idea, and that machshava techila, that initial idea, is the most important part of the whole process. And that person, as we said, has nothing to do with the manufacturing process, and possibly has nothing to do with the end product. What is common about the first and the last process, as opposed to the middle process, are two things. Both are involved with what, from a material point of view, would appear to be trivialities. And secondly, whereas the middle function, each one is involved in a portion of the whole, in the first and the last function, they're involved in the integrity of the whole. Those are the differences. Let's look at them again. The laborer feels he's done a worthwhile job of work. He's worked hard, he's sweated, and he's toiled, and look, here's the part that he's made. This one's made the engine, this one's made the wheel, this one's made the bonnet. Each one, or group, or each team has made a part. They can see clearly what they've done. The quality controller, his job is just to make sure that nobody makes mistakes, so you can't see what he did at all. you would see what he did if he wasn't there, but as long as he's there, you can't see what he did at all. That's the quality control. That's the most frustrating thing, that on the one hand, if you say to him, what did you do? His answer is nothing. None of it is mine. I didn't do anything. I can't point to one screw that I'm responsible for. That's the negative of his work. On the other hand, if you say to him, what division did you work in? Did you work in the division that made the wheels? Or did you work in the division that made the doors? Or did you work in the division that made the engine? He says, I worked everywhere. Every little detail of this car I've been involved in. But there's nothing to which I can point and say, that's mine. So on the one hand, there's a shleimus who's involved in the perfection and the completeness of the whole item. And on the other hand, he can't say any part of it is his. That's the mesivus nefesh. He's giving of himself to do a job of work which will never really be recognized. He's giving of himself to do a job of work which he can never point to and say, I made that. And nobody else can ever point to it and say, he made that, because he didn't. So he's working with enormous toil and taking an enormous responsibility on his shoulders without being able to say he did anything at all, without getting the credit for it. And the man who conceives of it also. He doesn't work with the real product, he doesn't work with the real material. He can't look at the product and say, I made that. All he can say is an idea. I designed it. So the first function and then the last function, the leadership, the conceiver, the designer, the inventor, and the last one, the manager who looks after quality, are both dealing with spiritual concepts, not with physical concepts. What the designer made was an idea, that's all. And what the end man did was an idea. The idea is called completion. The idea is called value. The idea is called quality. That's what he was busy with. But he didn't make an object. He didn't make a thing. He's not an engineer in that sense. He's not a manufacturer. He put all that intention into an idea, and that idea is terribly important, but nobody sees it. And the first man's idea is terribly important, but nobody knows about it. Nobody sees it. Those are the two roles that the Midrash points out, in the case of David HaMelech and in the case of Moshe Rabbeinu. David HaMelech didn't build the Beis HaMikdash. It was built after his death. But the Ribbono Shel Olam attributes it to him, because Ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu Mekapeach Shechar Kol Beriah. The Ribbono Shel Olam does notice the work that we do, and he notices the degree of dedication. Moshe Rabbeinu was prepared to sacrifice his comfort and his sleep for an idea which he knew couldn't come into being throughout his lifetime, but nevertheless he was Moser Nefesh for it. That was Moshe Rabbeinu. And so it's called his Beis HaMikdash, because he conceived of it. It was his idea. Somebody else put it together, somebody else manufactured it, doesn't matter. The concept was his, the idea was his, the vision was his. And because the vision was his, he's given full credit for it. The laborers who put it together, it's not theirs. Shlomo HaMelech who managed it, it's not his, it's David's. The Mishkan was put together by Bezalel, by Eliyahu, by the men and women who donated and worked for it, doesn't matter. They each were involved in a part of it. There, the concept of the Mishkan wasn't Moshe's, the concept of the Mishkan was Hashem's. So Moshe wasn't the originator of the idea, Moshe wasn't the designer, but Moshe was the quality controller, Moshe was the manager who made sure that everything was in order at the end. And in fact, if we look at these two characters, Moshe Rabbeinu and David HaMelech, there we see the essential difference between them in the work that they did, not just in terms of the Mishkan and the Beis HaMikdash, but in their whole careers. Moshe Rabbeinu, let's start with David HaMelech. David HaMelech was the leader. He was the visionary. He wasn't a manager in terms of a day-to-day thing necessarily. He didn't go around and attend to the day-to-day details. He had people doing that. But he was the man with a vision. He was the man with the ideas. He elevated the people and motivated the people and drove the people and saw the possibilities that there were. That was David HaMelech. He was the leader. Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't the leader. It wasn't Moshe's idea that they should come out of Mitzrayim. It wasn't his vision. It wasn't his vision that they should go to Eretz Yisrael. It wasn't his vision that they should receive the Torah. During that generation, Hashem was the leader. And that's what was specific and unique about that generation. It's the only generation that wasn't led by a human being. They were led by the Ribbono Shel Olam. And that's why Moshe's name doesn't feature in the Haggadah. Because in Haggadah we're celebrating the vision of Chayrus. That vision wasn't Moshe's. Moshe was just the manager, that's all. He put it all together, he made it work. And he gets a great deal of credit for that. But he wasn't the leader, he wasn't the originator of the idea. He wasn't a great orator, he used to stutter and stammer. He didn't have that kind of personality. Moshe was, that wasn't his greatness. His greatness was in translating Hashem's will meticulously and making sure that the design and the vision of the Ribbono Shel Olam came into perfect reality. Moshe was the quality controller. That's what Moshe was. And it's the same in teaching. We have these two facets of personality. We have sometimes the need to motivate, to idealize, to drive people. And we have the necessity to see that things are done properly, that there's a certain quality to the way the ideas are being absorbed, that the skills that are being learnt are accurate and are correct. In management we've got it. In parenting we've got it. In every aspect of life we've got these two facets, all three of them. But the two that concern us, on the one hand, the need to have vision and to be able to conceive of new ideas and to be innovative, and on the other hand, to pay attention to detail and to see that these ideas are put into practice in a meticulous way where they come to a point of completion, where the job is finished and completed and can be tied up and there are no loose ends, but the product has a quality to it and the product has value to it. That was Moshe Rabbeinu and that was David HaMelech. Two great leaders, each in a different way. Each one of them made a contribution, one to the Mishkan and one to the Beis HaMikdash. The contribution of each of them could not be seen in the finished product. There was nothing of the Mishkan that we could point to and say, that's what Moshe did. There was nothing in the Beis HaMikdash that we could point to and say, that's what Moshe did. Just as there is nothing at the dinner party or at any of the other examples that I gave that you can point to and say, that's what he did. If one did break it down into those components, it would appear trivial. Yet when one looks at the Beis HaMikdash in its entirety, one says this was the vision of David HaMelech. And when one looks at the perfection of the completion of every detail of the Mishkan, we say Vayehi Kechalois Moshe, when Moshe finished building the Mishkan, for this was the Mishkan of Moshe.